The Guardian.
Welcome back to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. This week, it's Double Trouble. I meet British actor Dominic Cooper to discuss his starring role alongside himself in The Devil's Double, in which he plays the man hired to double as Saddam Hussein's dangerous son, Uday. And bilingual, double-barreled Kristin Scott Thomas plays a journalist caught in the mire of French history in Sarah's Key. I'll be talking to the film's director, Gilles Paquet-Brenner, about putting guilt on the big screen. Also, Zan Brooks and I will be reviewing some of this week's other big releases, including J.J. Abrams' Super 8 and Jim Carrey in a flap in Mr. Popper's Penguins. Yes, it's the film podcast nobody can imitate. It's Film Weekly.
You'll have whatever you want. Everything I own will belong to you.
Uday, I am my father's son. I would give my last drop of blood for Iraq. But when this war is over, I'm going to work in his business. I am the eldest son. I have brothers and sisters. I have given them my word.
Sleep on it.
Uday, you are asking me to extinguish myself.
British actor Dominic Cooper beside himself there in The Devil's Double, a film which draws on the truth of Uday Hassan Hussein, the son of Saddam Hussein, who co-opts an old school friend, Latif Yahya, to be his stand-in during the early days of the First Iraq War, detailing the excesses and absolute moral corruption of the Hussein dynasty. Cooper puts in a bravura performance in what is his first proper lead. Best known previously for his roles in Mamma Mia and most recently Tamara Drew and perhaps The History Boys, both on stage and in film, The Devil's Double gave him ample room to illustrate that he's a real acting talent. I met up with Dominic this week in London and I began by asking him if it was always the filmmaker's intention to use the same actor for both parts.
It was. Initially, I just found the story so compelling. Anyhow, and then I'd see there's a little side note. It was kind of how Michael Thomas, the writer, always put in brackets. Remember, this is always the same actor playing both roles.
You know, you're playing a real-life character. Did you meet Latif before you played him? And how much could you do about Uday? Did you actually kind of, like, eye up the two real people that you were playing?
It was wonderful to just meet Latif and to know that, to remind oneself that these events did occur, whether we're being exact with the information or not, but I just wanted an idea of who they were, and then I could change them dramatically, physically, and make sure they had a very different vocal range and a very different way in which they behaved amongst other people and how they took up space. You know, it was rather than mimicking.
Yeah. I've seen all of the stuff you've done, actually. I quite like it because you're sort of like fairly young, so you haven't done too much stuff, and I've managed to see all of it. And this kind of knocks it out. This takes you to another level, Dominic, if I may say so. It really is kind of stretches you out, obviously, because you get two shots at it as well. But, I mean, it really is. It's kind of exciting, it's sad, it's kind of moving, but it's also kind of action as well, and it's kind of funny.
Yeah, I think that was important. But that was very difficult as well, to essentially be playing someone who I found extraordinarily revolting and everything I unearthed about.
This is Uday rather
this is now, than... This is now Uday, yeah. Sorry. One of my biggest problems, I mean, that I spoke to our director at length about was there's nothing I can find to empathise with or to really understand the inner workings of this human being and how he behaved in this way, how he functioned with no moral code and with no one really telling him what to do or what the limits of his behaviour were. So I had to find something within that person that I could not necessarily relate to or empathize with, but just at least understand where that sort of psychotic anger and aggression stemmed from. And that, for me, was about relating it to his past and who his father was and the difficulties he had with how his father didn't appreciate him or think he was capable of any military strength or right. And certainly wasn't prepared to hand him the reins of power. And that, I think, in that culture is extremely humiliating when that's just a rite of passage.
So that was your sort of psychological route into him rather than the kind of drug-taking, whoring murderer. Which obviously you don't do very much for yourself. I don't know about the murder.
No, exactly that. I needed something to kind of, if I was going to look through the eyes of this man or physically inhabit him and be in that mode, that sort of crazed, energetic, psychotic behaviour that I needed to know where that stemmed from. And with Latif, it was about what I needed to know and not necessarily pry too much. You know, you've met the guy, he's both mentally and physically scarred from what he has witnessed and been through in that excruciating position that he found himself in. And when it became clear that we weren't making biographical account of events, then I didn't feel it necessary to investigate or to disturb what was just healing, really.
Yeah. Is this an occasion when you're acting that sometimes you've got to let go? You obviously kind of think about these things quite a lot and were thoughtful on it, but it seems that some of this you've just got to be wild and really let go. And they always say the devil will get the best lines, but in this one the devil really, he gets the best clothes, certainly.
yeah, absolutely, a case of that complete faith and trust in the director, and then going, well, you know, this is how this guy behaved. I took a deep breath and I just went for it and went as extreme as possible, because everything that I found out about him was extreme and there was no resistance to anything. Everything was pushed to the limit. And actually that was, although difficult, was extremely exhilarating and, you know, what a great challenge, but actually really fun to not care and believe that Lee Tamahori would have said, that's just too much now. And there were facts about this man that were reined in, you know, things that we just wouldn't believe. But great fun to do it, and great fun to immerse yourself that much in someone, even though you despise them, but then have the relief of playing someone very, very different emotionally, very, very still, very considered in comparison. And the way in which we filmed it was that we jumped between the two very sporadically.
Yeah, can I talk about technically, how do you do that? Because in the old days, they'd always say, so when someone meets their double, they'd be like, oh, right, and how they've done it in mirrors. But obviously, technology's come on such a lot. I'm wondering how they do it now, because not only do you have scenes, I mean, you have a lot of scenes together with yourself.
Yeah, there were a number of ways to achieve this. We had not much budget and not much time, and we used something called motion control, which in simple terms, a camera on a head will film a master shot of me hopefully doing Uday, because that was he was the driving force within the scene. He laid out the architecture of how a scene is structured for me. I could go berserk and then we'd have to follow his lead, as it were. Then I'd run off, swap round clothes and get into the mind space of Latif, run back in, and then this camera would do exactly the same maneuver on its track and on its headshot. Therefore, you'd be able to paste the two together in the hope that all the art, and then sort of, I'd have Lee Tamahori would run around sticking green crosses to various marks on the wall, trying desperately to figure out and remember where the eye line should be. Now, if that was out by an inch, it doesn't work. So we were very lucky, and it was very creative and very in the moment. And the other option is to head replace, so another physical body with my head on it, and that's much more expensive and quite difficult to accomplish. We used that much less.
So you'd shoot your scene like later and they would digitize it onto them?
I would act the scene with someone else and then you'd put my head into that. Now, I'd normally be acting with an earpiece with the scene that I'd just done, and then Lee was having to make a decision about which take to use there and then, rather in the edit suite much later on, and then I was listening to myself give the performance as Uday as I was reacting and responding as Latif.
Well, they don't teach you this at Lambda.
No, they absolutely don't. But there were a number of things I did learn there that were quite helpful with this particular experience, actually.
There were no fencing in this that I remember. But it is, I mean, that's an amazing thing for you. I mean, for your career, to suddenly be doing that is really something coming from that little boy who was there on the History Boys at the National Theatre, which is kind of good old classic ensemble British stage playing, to doing this, which is kind of very, very technical kind of bit of work.
Yeah, I loved it for that very reason, actually. I've spent a lot of time on film sets, having been a runner. My brother's always produced music videos and commercials, so I was always on sets, and then I went into editing. So I've always found them really exciting places to just be around. It's a really creative, exciting, wonderful, diverse places where a lot of creativity is happening spontaneously, and I just love being part of that. I love, for the first time ever, having my ideas and considerations and were being taken seriously, and that we all needed to invest and put our heads together to try and achieve this, to make it work, to make this doubling up effect happen. And if I, you know, if you're doing a film where you come and do a line every so often, or they've been filming for 3 weeks and you turn them and say, oh, look, this is my character, here you go, and hope for the best, it can be frightening and daunting. And you don't feel you're ever in a position to really give your opinion. Because, and rightly so, I think, if you found someone that came in and suddenly started throwing their weight around with what this film should be, you'd despise them. But I felt part of it. I loved every moment of it. It was exhausting, but creatively brilliant.
Now, I mentioned the devil wearing all the best clothes, as she certainly does. What was your favourite outfit as Ute?
There was one in a nightclub that was just covered in silver zips, which was truly, and shoulder pads. So that was pretty. But the all-in-one motorcycle outfit as well was pretty hideous.
Because, I mean, you had both characters wore that. They both suddenly came out.
They just turn up. Well, the scene was meant to be that they turn up and you see them on the bikes, and then they turn up. But that, we couldn't have time, and it didn't really make any sense. It still doesn't make any sense at all that they both arrive in two motors.
That's funnier that way.
Yeah, it kind of does.
There's a wonderful silk shirt that he's got as well that's kind of, I don't know, it's just got the right sort of Arabi silk kind of gold. It kind of matches the gold taps of the palace that we're seeing.
Anne Shepherd, who did the costumes, was totally inspired with it, and was really very, they mean so much when you do character, when you play characters like this, you know, the very formal suit of Latif as opposed to this just as hideous as possible, you know, as expensive as possible but with the least amount of taste. Yeah. And you feel that it was like putting the teeth in for Uda, you know, you step into that stuff and you go, right, this is who this guy is. Yeah. And he loves it, and he relishes wearing this ostentatious sort of vulgar costume.
Mm. Do you remember Dick Emery, the comedian who was on the telly? He's pretty before your time, young man. Know, yeah. But he always used to stick teeth in before doing the vicar.
So good, though. It completely changes your, well, it changes the shape of your mouth, so therefore you get, for the character that you've developed, as soon as you put them in, you can click into it immediately, and that really helped with something like this, because you had to be that immediate with it.
Alec Guinness in Kind Hearts and Coronets was a lot of teeth acting as well.
Yeah, I'm going to now, from now on, it's all about having different teeth made. I swear. I should keep that a secret.
Yeah, exactly. This week I should be having a special tooth, your personal tooth doctor. Did you keep any of the clothes? Have you still got them in your closet? I bet you have.
I have the motorcycle outfit, and I have the teeth.
Yeah. And you wear them at home, don't you, in front of the mirror?
Always.
Dominic, congratulations, Devil Dom. I hope we'll hear a lot more of it. I really, really enjoyed it. Really terrific performance.
Thanks nice so to see much. You. Nice to see you too. Thank you.
Many thanks to Dominic Cooper there, and The Devil's Double is on general release here in the UK from Wednesday, the 10th of August. Now for some double trouble in action. I'm joined by Guardian critic and writer at large, Zan Brooks. Zan, welcome back.
Thank you, Jason.
I was going to play you myself, if that's all right.
Fine. You do me better than I do me.
Put your head on me afterwards, as you wish. Zan, this week we're going to look at Super 8, produced by Spielberg and directed by J.J. Abrams. You could tell me about Mr. Popper's Penguin, starring Jim Carrey, and I shall give you a little bit of my French can-can,
I look forward to that.
Yeah, but let's start with Super 8. It is a summer movie in the summer season. As I said, it is produced by Steven Spielberg and kind of goes back to his old 1970s aesthetics. Things like E.T. And the Goonies are revived as the young filmmakers in the film begin to shoot a scene. They witness a major train crash.
Oh my gosh. How could a pickup truck derail a train, man? That's impossible.
Obviously it isn't.
Oh my god. I know that truck. Oh, guys. Is that him?
Yeah. It's him.
Who?
It is.
Yeah, for sure.
Who is it?
Dr. Woodward.
Dr. Woodward, the science guy?
Biology.
Honors biology.
Wow. I'm not in his class.
We had Elle Fanning there, Riley Griffiths, a bunch of kids with braces and 70s t-shirts. I thought these kids really looked like 70s kids, you know, BMX bikes and everything.
Yeah, they did. It really kind of indulges that sort of nostalgia kick of late 70s small town USA, where they kind of, you know, it's before Xboxes and things like that, so they ride around on bikes and shoot films, not on camcorders, but on little Super 8 cameras.
Do you think these days they don't even go out the house, they're just kind of playing video games?
I think that's probably the case, isn't it? And, you know, we're roughly the same age as J.J. Abrams, so we can kind of maybe indulge this kind of kick. It's a very shrewd move getting a producer credit for Spielberg on this, because then he can't sue.
Yes.
And this is very much a homage and a salute.
Because what do you, I want to make a film like you used to make. In fact, yeah, almost exactly the same as you used to make. Yeah. Can you come and want to see? Because yeah, fine. Here you go. I'll even give you some of the bikes from E.T.
Yeah, and Spielberg's those films of Spielberg were a kind of very nice mix of, you know, David Lean type spectacle with almost like live action Disney kind of stuff, and this kind of evokes that whole vibe. It's character based. It's got a kind of nice attention to detail, and it's very good so far as it goes. And I think like for the first half, I was completely swept along by this and thought it was lovely.
Yes, it was brilliant when the kids are making their film, yeah, and all they want to do is get this film into a film festival. And it's got very much like a, what's that thing with Michael Rod? It was a screen test.
Let's get
the film as we can send it into screen test. It's going to be great. It's sort of the Son of Rambo kind of aesthetic,
yeah,
that we
but
had.
But then you've got the alien
then
thrown
suddenly
in there.
There's something happening with an alien. And, yeah, and in classic E.T. fashion, you've got the military as well, that, yeah, kind of mysterious force. And all that Spielbergian single parents, because Elle Fanning's got a single parent. And then, of course, the main kid, who's... Mum dies at the beginning.
And so, yeah,
so there's that kind of the sense of home being lost because there's evacuations. There's, yeah, all of that going
on. It's that real coming of age template, isn't it? Where you're suddenly aware of the adult world, and the adult world is maybe not as trustworthy as you thought it was. And your friends are the kind of the key thing that you've got to kind of bind together with and fight this sort of oppressive, yeah, force.
And
that's
I like
coming
that.
In.
I like kids making movies. I think that's a kind of, yep, cool thing. And ones are doing effects, and then one falls in love with the lead, Elle Fanning, who's brilliant. Elle Fanning.
Yeah, she's great,
isn't she? She, yeah, was great in Somewhere, I thought, for Sofia Coppola.
She was,
well,
yeah.
She's,
yeah,
really good in this as well. And there's a then here, though.
Well, there is a then. And the weird thing that I had when watching this is that I kind of aged during the process of the film, that I started out full of sort of childlike, wide-eyed wonder, and completely immersing myself in this film, and then gradually turned into, you know, an old curmudgeon again as it went on, the longer it went on. A critic, I guess. Yes, that's that's what we call them. And I think that's because homage is only good as long as it's a springboard and it needs to then become something else. And this sort of didn't.
I thought that the filmmaking stuff, which was great fun, where they capture the train footage, yeah, and you think, oh, that could be the key. It stopped being the key to the film, and it started being about the monster and his little lair and all that. And I thought that was from another movie. You know,
it was from another movie, and the movie that it was from was much more machine-tooled and bland than this wonderfully idiosyncratic amateur movie that they were making. And I kept thinking, I want to see more of that.
Yeah.
And it does just indulge itself in this nostalgia kick. So it's just sort of, instead of being a springboard, it's just bouncing up and down on the same trampoline of all these sort of Spielberg films that he obviously loves and we love too. But they've been made, they're done. So do something else with it. Use that as your starting point, but then build.
Yeah, and capture that essence as well. The great, yeah, thing about E.T. is that there is this kind of friendship with the kid and there is a bit of love, and then it soars. And that's so obviously playing in the background here, but it doesn't quite have that. It doesn't develop into that majesty. I thought at one point this was going to be a masterpiece, like one of the best summer movies,
yeah,
I've ever seen. And I think half of it is.
Half of it
is.
And
then it does sail off.
But it's too much a salute. It's like a sort of brilliant Madame Tussauds representation of a Spielberg movie. But you want a little bit more heart in there. And that's to take nothing away from the performers who give it their all and are great. I think the blame is with Abrahams, and it's too much of a kind of an academic pastiche as opposed to his own movie.
Yeah, and also, I think the monster, again,
yeah,
much scarier when you don't see it.
Absolutely.
Then he shows it quite a lot, and you're like, it's not that good a monster.
Yeah, first really. Rule of filmmaking.
Yeah,
is,
don't show your monsters. Nevertheless, I do think it's a very good summer movie.
It is, yeah.
Quite scary in parts. I don't know how young people are these days with scariness, but they've probably seen it all.
They're
on video
all jaded,
game.
Aren't they?
They don't care, do
they're
they? Like... but I did enjoy it, and I do think Elle Fanning was terrific. Better than her sister Dakota, I think.
Yeah, Dakota's sort of ridden off the
She's
rails.
She's gone, isn't she, now?
She's past it.
So old, gone. Zan, tell me about Jim Carrey and Mr. Popper's Penguins. I did not pop into this.
I can't think why you didn't, Jason. This, I don't know. I mean, this feels like a film that's arrived about 5 years after the Penguin craze. What was it? It was Happy Feet.
And the March of the Penguins.
March of the Penguins, of course. And Mr. Penguin's Big Adventure.
Yeah, and Penguins 3.
Penguins 3D.
in this one, he plays, there's a New York zookeeper called Nat, and he arrives to collect the penguins off Popper, who is keen to not disappoint his wife or birthday boy Billy by taking away these popular and lovable pets.
Thomas Popper?
Uh-huh.
Nat Jones, New York Zoo, Flightless Bird Division. Your assistant called, the one with the pee problem. I'm here for the penguin. Oh, wow. She didn't tell me they were gentoos. How many do you have?
Five?
Six.
Six?
Yeah.
Oh, God, even better.
What's going on?
Oh, that's nothing. I'll take care of it. Hey, save me a piece of that.
I've got my team downstairs and a fully equipped retrieval van.
Yeah, it's great. But listen, you can't actually take the penguins right now.
What are you talking about?
Believe me, I'd love to give them to you. But it's my kid's birthday and he's crazy about them. You know kids.
I don't know kids. I know penguins. They like ice, snow, and fish. Put them in a New York apartment, they're going to get beak rash and wing mange faster than you can blow out your birthday candles.
Wing mange?
It's not pretty.
There they go. Does Mr. Popper pick up a penguin?
He does. They more likely they pick up him. This is the your classic Hollywood redemption story.
With penguins.
With penguins in the guise of Jesus, I guess, or an angel, flapping their wings. Jim Carrey is a hard-ass New York real estate tycoon who Well, you've got a leap of faith.
Yeah,
there are penguins in this. If you can't get... if you can't take on board that Jim Carrey is a real estate tycoon, you're going to struggle with this.
I can see him dancing with penguins and being a friend of... I can't see him doing the hard-ass thing.
No, he struggles with that. He's trying to buy the New York restaurant Tavern on the Green
Park. It's in Central Park.
Yeah. Which is owned, I think, in the film, but not in real life, by Angela Lansbury, who doesn't want to sell it to a cold-hearted businessman. She wants it to go to someone who loves her. And so she doesn't really like Jim Carrey, but then she likes Jim Carrey when he's got the penguins in tow and the penguins run amok through New York. And they teach him a little bit about life.
Do they?
They do, unfortunately.
Are they like Babe in Pig, Lost in the City?
No, Babe Pig in the City is a great film.
Yeah, but
it's
they're
very
in
dark.
New York and there's Lost and they're in the city.
It's not
New
even
York.
New York in that, is it? It's a sort of, it's an
Isn't
every
it?
Town, every city.
So the penguins do run
We're
amok in New York.
Here, aren't we?
No, but I mean, animals are mocking you. So like Crocodile Dundee in
a
New
little
York.
Bit more like that. And it's quite an interesting career crossroads
for who? For the penguins.
For the penguins are going to go on to greater things. Jim Carrey, I think, is struggling a little bit. I mean, you know, he's gone through. He's had the heyday of the great dazzling physical comedian.
Yeah.
He's had the time where he's tried to be a serious actor. With
Man
like
in
Man
the
on the Moon.
Good.
And Eternal Sunshine, which was great.
And Truman Show. Even.
And Truman Show. And now you sense that he's struggling, and he's being fitted into. This is the sort of role that 10 years ago Robin Williams would have played.
Mm.
The kind of lovable guy who starts out a bit grumpy, but then learns to sort of rediscover his inner Robin Williams.
Yeah. Is it Eddie Murphy managed it? He made that kind of.
Did.
I'm going to work with the animals now.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not Beverly Hills Cop, and now he's kind of done the Norbit thing and ruined everything.
He's ruined everything. Whereas Jim Carrey's kind of almost jumped straight to Norbit. With this a little bit.
Oh dear.
And there's a slight sort of whiff of desperation about him.
Are they real penguins?
They're real penguins, but there's a little bit of CGI jiggery pokery going along. So there's sort of dance formations where they're all doing the dance.
Yeah, I've seen all that, and that's a bit Dick Van Dyke and Mary
Poppins. Yeah, yeah. I didn't like it.
No, I don't. I didn't think
enough.
I would, and you know what? You're not convincing me.
You dodged the penguin.
Okay, that's Mr. Popper's Penguins Pop, if you will. Will kids like it?
No.
Not yours.
Not the smart ones.
No, exactly.
The dumb smart ones.
Yeah,
they'll lap it up.
Est-ce que ça vous plairait d'être danseuse, mademoiselle?
Oui, on sait ce que ça veut dire.
Qu'est-ce que vous voulez à ma fille?
Elle m'intéresse beaucoup, chère madame.
Ma fille est une honnête fille, monsieur.
Je n'en doute.
I'm going to change notes a little bit. Jean Renoir, one of my favourite film directors of all time.
He's never worked with penguins.
I don't think he has worked with penguins, although someone will probably say, actually, in
1924,
in Jean. Yes, exactly. That was my Philip French impression, for anyone listening. The rules of the penguin. And French Cancan, he worked in Hollywood for 15 years, came back to France and joined up with Jean Gabin, who is one of the great one of the great actors of all time.
You think?
Irrespective,
wow.
Irrespective of all nationalities. I just think he's one of the great screen actors. And I hadn't seen him for ages, and then really lovely to be reminded of him. He plays the impresario of the newly opened Moulin Rouge, and he kind of casts his new Nini, she's called. He finds a sort of washerwoman on the streets of Pigalle and casts her as his new dancer in the Can-Can. And it's all about putting on the show. It's kind of classic backstage Hollywood musical stuff, but done in the French style.
So when was this made? Like 1950s?
1952. And in Technicolor.
Yeah.
As well, and great use of Technicolor, and very stage bound as well, which is why Truffaut is such a big fan of this, because it kind of the day for night stuff that Truffaut kind of draws attention to making the film. This is so set bound; it never looks like it's on a real street at all, and it just if you want to know how to make a climax in the movie, we're talking at J.J. Abrahams, who kind of lets things go a bit and just kind of puts pyrotechnics on the screen. This builds and builds to the big dance number at the end, and it is just one of the most joyous sequences in all of cinema.
Why have I not seen this film?
I don't know. You need to see French Can-Can. Some of it is a bit sort of like, oh, a bit old-fashioned, and there's a bit of French clowning around some physical comedians you could well do without. I'd cut them out if I was doing it again. But the climax with the Can-Can is just masterful filmmaking, and Renoir is a master of that, and he can sort of do there's because he's of course the grandson of Renoir, of Auguste. There's lots of tributes to all those impressionists, to Trek, all of that. It's very painterly, the compositions, and brilliantly so, and it's
and presumably needs to be seen on big screen.
Yeah, I mean, it just is sumptuous, and it reminded me, you know what it reminded me most of is The Red Shoes, in a way. It's about
people, sounds like that, the like whole set bound kind of,
and how do you put the show on, and you know, the sacrifice for the show,
art and life and career. And
he gives a big lecture about, you know, the reason that I'm not actually sleeping with another person now in the chorus line is because, you know, this theatre is the big, he has a great speech,
the muse,
about
isn't
theater,
it? That's the excuse I use.
Yes, absolutely, quite right. French Can-Can, it is on re-release, I think, around the country. Do seek it out because it's been restored in the most beautiful way, and it just looks superb. So I really, it's one of my treats of the year.
Okay, don't put this in your top 10. You have this horrible habit of putting reissues in your end-of-year top tens.
It's not allowed.
No, it's not allowed.
It's not fair.
You did Accident, I think, a year or two ago.
Yeah, it was good, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was good, but it was good in 1960,
whatever. What about Cutter's Way? Am I allowed that in?
No, 1981. If you're doing your top ten 1981, put Cutter's Way in.
What about Super 8? Is that 1979 or is that now?
That's 1979.
No, you see, I can't have that.
But it wouldn't be in there anyway.
Mr. Popper's Penguins, that's my choice.
That's up there.
Zan, lovely to have you back and to lock horns with you. I look forward to doing it next week.
See you then.
For all of Zan Brooks's writings and videos, go to the best film site in the universe, guardian.co.uk/film. Based on the critically acclaimed novel Elle s'appelait Sarah by Tatiana de Rosnay, the film Sarah's Key tells of a Paris-based American journalist, Julia Jaramon, played by Kristin Scott Thomas, and her research into the history of an apartment she's purchasing in Paris' Marais district. What unfolds is a story mired in occupied France's connection with the Holocaust and the tragedy of children caught in its horror.
I want to do something on the state ruling in favor of that deportee's daughter in her case against the French government and the SNCF.
Oh, she won?
Breaking news. Yes, Chirac's speech in 95 at the Valdiv has finally served some purpose.
Chirac at the what?
The Valdiv.
How do you spell that?
You're joking.
What happened?
In July 1942.
On the 16th and 17th of July 42, they arrested 13,000 Jews, mostly women and children. They took 8,000 of them, put them in the Velodrome d'Hiver, in inhuman conditions.
Imagine the Superdome in New Orleans, only a million times worse.
A million times worse. And then they sent them to the camps.
Well, you seem to know your stuff.
Mm-hmm. I covered the 60th anniversary for Time magazine. I wanted to do a feature, and they gave me half a page. Which is why you're going to give me 10 pages.
10 pages?
Mm-hmm.
No, Julia, I can't give you 10 pages.
Why not? Readers love history. Most of them haven't even heard of it. Look at these guys.
And I'm delighted to say that the director of Sarah's Key, Gilles Paquet-Brenner, joins me on the line from Paris. Congratulations on Sarah's Key, Gilles. How did you manage to approach this story? Because you've got the two strands, 1942 and then the modern day story with Kristin Scott Thomas seeking for her past. Did you think, well, I'm going to shoot these two very differently? Did you shoot them at different times, indeed?
Yes, I did. So, I mean, it's the same structure than in the book, because Sarah's Key is based on the book, of course, by Tatiana de Rosnay. And you have two storylines intersecting and having resonance one on the other. And so one is in 1942, and you follow this little girl, Sarah, who's arrested by French police in July 1942. And you follow this American journalist, because Christine plays an American journalist in the film, and who's going to discover that that she's linked to this little girl.
So is it like making two different films?
Yes, kind of. It's two different films, but that have to be one at the end, and that's the challenge. So we really worked very hard on the script to be sure that that the story would stay fluid, and that that it would have resonance one with the other. And yeah, it's shot differently. I mean, the 1942 period is very realistic, very raw, like a handheld camera with short lenses. And the contemporary piece is way more classic.
Yeah, which is interesting because normally you'd think, well, you'd go for a classic look for the period film and then a kind of bit more edgy stuff for the modern look. But you definitely change that round, and it's very noticeable watching that. So I was kind of admiring that approach.
But, well, yeah, because I think, I hate period pieces that look like period pieces. You know what I mean? That feels fake. So I really wanted to feel very realistic and raw.
I'm interested in the reaction to films like Sarah's Key, and very recently here in England as well, we had La Rafle, which was translated as The Roundup by Rose Bosch, which depicted the night of the Veldiv Roundup, where the Jews were rounded up and taken to the Cycle Stadium. It's a film about the same time as yours, but a very different approach to it. But I was wondering how French audiences, clearly there's no coincidence, these two films that are quite rare, dealing with a subject that France doesn't deal with very often, are coming out now. Is there a reason for this, and how is France sort of finding itself viewing that situation now?
Yeah, that's true that both the two movies were released the same year, but I think it all started with the book, actually, because Tatiana released the book in 2007, I think, early 2007. Mm-hmm. And then you had the two movies. So I don't know why, sometimes it's in the air. It's pretty often that you have like two movies on the same subject but maybe it's because now, like 70 years later, almost 70 years later, we have the right distance to address that issue, because I think, after the war, French society was totally torn apart. You had the collaborators, the resistance, the communists, etc. And so the major urgency was to reunite French society so we could live together again. And because we had a strange war in France, we didn't get bombed like for months and months like you unfortunately in London. We lost the war like very quickly, and then we're an occupied country administrated by the Germans, and also with a French collaborative government. And so it was a huge, huge national shame for years and years. And also you had this period of time, like in the 50s, 60s, and even 70s, where you had the people in charge, like politicians or businessmen or journalists, that nobody wanted to be asked, what were you doing during the war? Because some of them maybe were not on the right side of things.
Is it something that's a personal story for you, Gilles? I don't know why you were particularly attracted to this story. I mean, I'm Jewish myself, so obviously these sort of stories impact on me as a viewer and as a critic very, very personally in a way. But thank God none of this happened to any of my immediate family. What was your family situation? Are you have you Jewish blood in you? Is your family part of that?
Yes, I'm from Jewish background. My grandfather, I mean, all his family, they were German Jews from Berlin, and he emigrated in France and married my grandmother, and he was actually arrested in the Free Zone in 1943 by the French police, and he died in Majdanek.
Oh.
So, yeah, it's obviously very personal to me. But so that's not the only reason why I was, so attracted by this material. I think it's also because it's a great story. I mean, the book is a page-turner, and I fell in love with it when I read it. And what's interesting, in my opinion, really interesting, is this contemporary point of view on history. Because, 40% of the movie, of course, address the facts, but it also addressed the consequences on future generations, which I think is very interesting, and which I had to deal with on a personal level, because my mother lost her father when she was two, so she has no memories of it. She tells me she has one, maybe, but I don't know if she invents herself this memory, you know what I mean, because she needs it. And I had to deal also with a grandmother who lost the love of her life. So I think it was interesting to deal with the consequences on future generations, because it's interesting to see now, and especially for the young generations, to show how history and the past affects our present.
And I think much of your film is set, if not filmed, in the Marais, one of the great tourist districts now of Paris. Everyone, any tourist who goes there for the weekend from here, from the UK, from America, they love the Marais. Let's wander around the Marais. Let's eat a shawarma. Let's have a nice kind of look at the Jews in the Marais, and then or let's buy a nice apartment in the Marais or stay in a hotel in the Marais. Well, you never know what was hiding in the closets in any of those buildings nowadays. That really readdressed my kind of thoughts on on the marriage.
Yeah, you're not going to see the marriage.
No, is that where you live? I mean, a lot of filmmakers.
No, I live in the 7th district.
Oh, well, that's all right. You're fine there. can we just talk very briefly about Kristin Scott Thomas as well? Obviously, a British actress who we know and love well here, and whom I'm chairman of the Critics Circle here in the UK, and we awarded her our High Achievement Award last year for her work. What particularly now that she's doing work in French and English, and it's very rare that actually in your film she gets to do her work in both. Although she's got an American accent in this one, but she actually uses both her skills in this one. What attracted you to her? Is it that bilingualism, or is there a certain element of her, I suppose, her presence on screen, which is just perfect for the role?
Well, a lot of things, actually. I mean, first, I think Kristin is one of the finest actresses in the world, and I'm sure you won't argue with me on this. And also, people may or may not know that, but she's been living in Paris for 30 years. And we were looking for this American journalist that would speak perfect French. And so in a French perspective, I mean, Kristin is the character, because Kristin was married to this French guy. She has three French children. Mm. And so nobody can understand the character better than her. And it was... She was almost troubled by that in a way, you know.
Well, I must admit, because it was quite personal. Because I mean, they only recently broke up her personal relationship in France, and this is you know, something that she had to decide to do in the film as well. So it must have hit home to her.
For sure, and also their in-laws were from Jewish background too, and like her mother-in-law has experienced that, and her parents-in-law in general, like they had to hide during the war, so she was very familiar with the subject, and she really hoped one day she could address it in the movie. And so the movie happened, and also more specific about acting with her is that she's a very elegant and very smart actress, and she always knows how to find the right distance, which is very important for this movie, because we didn't want to be, you know, manipulative or too sentimental, and Kristin is perfect for that. So it was not like, why would I, you know, ask Kristin? It's like, would I be crazy not to ask her, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, I think it's a part she wants to play. It makes total sense. And I'm now talking to you, Gilles, and knowing how personally involved you were with such a story as well, I admire that the fact that it wasn't a sentimental experience. It wasn't, you know, the violins playing. It was you managed.
No, it's emotional, but not sentimental, which
absolutely.
Is very different.
Very, very different as well. So congratulations on Sarah's Key, a very beautiful film, which I'm very glad is out here in the UK. And I'm very glad you could join me on Film Weekly to discuss it. Gilles Parquet. Brenner, merci beaucoup.
Thank you.
Sarah's Key goes on UK release from this Friday, the 5th of August. And that's all for this week. The music we've been featuring on the show is the score from The Devil's Double by young British composer Christian Henson. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on Film Weekly, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.